We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour, Focus, we'll be spending some time talking about the development of the telephone and the telegraph and how those came to be widespread. And one of the interesting features of the story that we'll be talking about is in the early days of both of those mediums, it certainly wasn't the idea that they would be widespread and that they would be commonly used by everyone. We'll also talk about the role of politics and regulation in this, and it certainly is something that connects to where we are today as we think about how it is we make sure that today's medium of telecommunications, things like the internet, are available to everybody and whether or not there is a role for government to play in that. Our guest for the program is Richard John. He's an historian of communications. He specializes in the political economy of communications in the United States and has written about the development of the telephone and the telegraph and the early years of the postal service. And he is the author of a recently published book. The title of his book is Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications. It is published by Belknap Harvard and has been out for a while now. Our guest, Richard John, is professor of journalism at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University, and he's speaking to us from there. And we also want to say thanks to the folks at Columbia for providing the studio on that end so we can have a high-quality connection between there and here. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send your questions by email, you may do that too. The address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are certainly welcome. And Professor John, hello.
Hello, David.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
We appreciate it. And, you know, I think I want to make sure right at the beginning to say how interesting a story this is, and because I think that maybe if I had said something like, we're going to talk about the history of regulation of telephone and telegraph, I think a lot of people would say, that's okay, I have something else to do. But that, in fact, it is a quite an interesting story as you look at how it is that these things, like the telephone, for example, that now we take for granted and, you know, everybody, almost everybody on the street has one in their pocket, how it is we got from the point where that this was new to the point where we are now. Actually, there are a lot of really interesting stories here.
Yeah, it was a real surprise for me to do the research on the telephone because I had assumed, like most previous historians, that the story of telephone was the story of the Bell system and AT&T and long distance and technological innovation. But in fact, it's an intensely political story, and it's a story that really is centered at the municipal level. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of surprising. The telegraph, we think of as a medium succeeded by telephone. Yet in the case of the telegraph, the key regulatory regime, the key the forum was at the state level. And in the telephone, it was a municipal level. Yeah. And that came to me as a great surprise in the course of doing the research.
And I think it is something that we can connect to where we are now because, well, for example, the Obama administration has said that it really believes that access to broadband is very important and has announced plans to try to subsidize broadband, particularly in those areas that are not now served, like rural areas in particular. And I'm sure that there are some people who look at that and say, oh, this is just not necessary, that the market will take care of this, that government should get out of it, that there should be as little regulation as possible, and that they might say, and that's kind of the way that it's always been. Well, the fact of the matter is that's not the way it's always been, that politics and government have historically here, in the case of these other mediums, have really had a very important role to play.
That's absolutely correct. The concept of a civic mandate for access to communications is almost as old as the Republic. It was institutionalized in the early Republic, that is to say the first half of the 19th century, in postal policy. And the development of the telegraph and the telephone were both related in interesting ways, institutionally and culturally, with that prior network, the postal network, so that in a way, politics is inescapable in telecommunications. It always, or in internet policy, and it always has been. And one of the interesting really dimensions of this story is the extent to which we've fooled ourselves into believing that's not the case. That is to say, we fooled ourselves into believing that it's merely economic or merely technological. And certainly, as you look around the world, there are many different ways you can configure communications networks, but you don't have to go abroad. You just look at the history in the United States and you see the indispensable role played by a regulation at the state, municipal, and federal level right from the beginning. So the question really isn't whether or not we're going to have regulation. It's what kind of regulation and what goals we're going to try to promote and who was going to be the beneficiaries and who are going to be the losers.
Yeah, I think it's particularly has always been interesting to me to look at how these things develop, telephone, telegraph, and also broadcasting, and make comparisons between the United States and other countries, where in other countries it seemed that the government was much more heavily involved. When broadcasting came along, for example, they seemed to think, well, this is kind of like the Postal Service, so we're going to regulate it in a similar way. And here in the United States, at least the way that we think about it, sort of the myth attached, is that with all of these things, with broadcasting and with the other communications, telecommunication medium, that it was just all wildcatters, just all out there doing their thing independently, and the government was never really involved. Unless maybe the government had to step in and sort of eliminate confusion and so forth. And again, that's just not the way we think of it. It's just not the way that it developed.
The early radio business was wide open in the United States before the enactment of the Radio Act of 1927. And certain students of the subject will say, well, the Radio Act of 1927 was terrible because it helped the big players. It destroyed opportunity for innovation. But in fact, the Radio Act did two things that were really quite important and in some ways quite radical. The first was that it decreed that there would be no private ownership of the airwaves. And that clause of the Radio Act, it seems to me, grew out of prior debates over telephone business. Would the telephone franchise, for example, be private? Would it be public? What would be the nature of it? Because these early radio stations had a municipal orientation. But the second important clause of that act was that it decreed that there would be segmentation between the provisioning of content and the connectivity, that is to say, the provisioning of the network itself. And that distinction between content and connectivity, we just take for granted in this country that, well, of course AT&T wouldn't have its own radio stations because AT&T provided the backbone for the networks. That is to say, the radio networks and the television networks for many, many decades sent their signals out over the telephone networks. Well, why didn't AT&T have its own telephone and radio stations? Well, it wasn't a technological outcome. It wasn't an economic outcome. It was a political outcome, and it was institutionalized in the Radio Act of 1927. So, yes, we've had no BBC in this country, and the levels of support for journalism broadcast are lower per capita than they are in many European countries, and that's a policy choice we've made. But to claim that the free market or the unfettered competition has determined the shape of American communications networks is simply demonstrably not true. And I think it's important not only that citizens we realize that, but the policymakers recognize that the decisions that they're making have consequences, and that they are, in a sense, are inevitably so. That is to say, they cannot avoid their responsibility to shape the communication networks of the future.
Well, I certainly think that it's interesting you raise that question about people talking about whether the content providers and the connectivity providers should be allowed to be the same, or whether that's important for that to be broken up. Because it's interesting to note that people were thinking about it back then, because it's still an issue right now when it comes to the internet, whether or not we think that it's a good idea for your internet provider also to be in the business of providing and generating the content.
That's absolutely right. And we can go back before radio to get a sense of what the stakes were. In the 1880s, for example, Western Union was the key network provider for electrical communication, which at that time took the form of telegraph, and the Associated Press, which was a New York-based organization that was actually distinct from the present-day Associated Press. The Associated Press had a number of collusive relationships with a Western Union, some covert, some open. And that relationship, the idea that there was a nexus between the providing of the network and the providing of the content, was an extraordinarily contentious political issue. And it's important, I think, to remember that it was a contentious political issue not only and not even primarily for farmers or laborers, that is to say groups on the outskirts of the corridors of power, just peeking in, but it was an issue for those at the center. It was an issue for merchants. It was an issue for newspaper editors. It was an issue for the educated general public, that we should not have that close relationship between the content and the network. And in fact, legislation that was enacted in the 1880s helped to break that link. And the agent of it, ironically enough, or surprisingly enough, was one of the most notorious of American a businessman, a fellow known as the archetypal robber baron, once called Mephistopheles by a business historian, a fellow by the name of Jay Gould, mm-hmm. and that he was in the center of this. So I'm not suggesting that the reformers or the interested groups that want to promote a civic mandate are in any sense divorced from the economic and technological struggles. In other words, they're in the center. And one of the I think lessons of the book, if a history book can have a lesson, is the importance of listening to the voices of players who were quite close to the center, and often they are the ones who are, at least historically, have done the most to shape the legislative outcomes, and therefore to shape the landscape in which the businesses, which have been largely promoted and financed by private capital, that they will develop. So the business opposition to corporate aggrandizement matters.
Our guest is Richard John. He's an historian of communications, and he specializes in the political economy of communications in the U.S. and is the author of a recent book that looks at the development of the telephone and the telegraph in the United States. His book is Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications. The Belknap Press of Harvard University Press is the publisher. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And I should also mention that our guest, Richard John, is professor of journalism at Columbia University. I should give you the opportunity to talk in a little bit more detail about the telegraph and the telephone, starting with the telegraph. And one of the things that's interesting here in this story is that apparently the man who invented it, Samuel Morse, his idea was that the telegraph system should be owned by the government.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Morse built a reputation for himself as a portrait painter. And he came upon the telegraph in part by accident, and his contribution was really not that original. We've known this for decades. He was a tireless promoter with a single-minded, almost obsessive vision that the commercial pressures that might shape the telegraph would be pernicious and would be very destructive of the civic values that he admired. And therefore, he lobbied unsuccessfully, ultimately, for many years to sell his patent rights to the government. Now, the story is a little bit more complicated because, of course, you ask, well, where did Samuel Morse's patent rights come from? Mm-hmm. And the patent rights came from the very institution, the federal government, that he was trying to sell the rights to. So that's nice work if you can get it. There were many other claimants for the telegraph, but Morse had a very close personal relationship with the patent commissioner, Henry Levitt Ellsworth. In fact, as time went on, Morse falls in love with Ellsworth's daughter. And it's this very close relationship that in some ways poisons his attempt to sell his invention. And as a consequence, the telegraph is commercialized by promoters, including rivals of Morse. It's not Morse and his inner circle that create the successful first mover in the telegraph business. It's Morse's opponents. That's different from the story in the telephone, but it is a reminder that invention, in some ways, is much less important than innovation. Mm-hmm. And the real innovators in the telegraph did not emerge until the 1850s, when they recognized the potential for commercializing it on a profitable basis by taking advantage of certain state laws that that concerned a right-of-way. Morse did not have that vision. He never claimed to be a businessman. And I think that his reputation as an inventor is greatly exaggerated. And just a final note on Morse, one reason his reputation is so exaggerated is because that's what he was intent upon promoting. That is to say, in the end, he was less concerned about making money than becoming famous. And he got what he wanted. He got the Supreme Court ruling that enshrined him as the inventor of the telegraph, but the same ruling opened the door to rivals. And if Morse's if Morse's backers had not been so committed to creating his reputation, he might have done better financially, but been less well known. So in a way, his very reputation is an artifact of the political economy in which he operated.
Well, this here, I think, is another interesting part of the story, and that is in this time, and in the persons of Samuel Morse and also Alexander Graham Bell, you see the beginnings of the idea of the heroic inventor, something that I guess didn't really exist before, and that you write about how it is that, in fact, the idea of that character, the heroic inventor, ends up being created and promoted by people who are interested in promoting telephone and telegraph, but that in fact they, aside from initially developing the technology, they didn't really have that much to do with how it was developed subsequently.
That's absolutely right. And the story is even a little bit more complicated. Before the 1830s, it was very difficult to make money on an invention by patenting it. And that's because our patent system had no mechanism for certifying inventions. That is to say, before 1836, the federal government simply said, okay, we'll give you a patent, and then you'll fight it out in the courts with other rivals. In 1836, there was a reform. Henceforth, the patent office would certify an invention as original and as having been preceded chronologically other inventions. Now, as soon as you set out those two criteria, originality and precedence, then in effect you create a political environment in which it's very much to the advantage of inventors and their champions to claim that their inventor was heroic. They thought about this idea by themselves many years ago before any possible rival. And those stories then emerged in order to justify legal prerogatives that they had obtained through the patent system. So the heroic inventor, it's not only that the inventors often don't promote and commercialize, but that their very reputation for invention has been boosted, often to entirely extravagant lengths, by the demands of the patent system and the cultural presumption that great inventions are the products of solitary individuals, which is almost never the case historically, but it is almost always the case in children's books, and lamentably so even in works of the history of technology.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that here where we are in Champaign County, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hi. I again missed the very first part of the show. I was kind of urged to call because my ears went up when you were emphasizing how we should be aware that, you know, what's called free enterprise is to be largely credited for developments. And maybe you said something at the beginning that contraries that. That's the truism that doesn't need to be emphasized. It seems to me that particularly with the modern development networks, telecommunications, that what needs to be emphasized is how much of this was de facto military-industrial policy, the DARPANET and all of that. So it's something I call about fairly regularly when there's an opportunity, because it seems to me that the other line of discourse is the one that is a commonplace and a truism, and that people don't recognize that massive defense spending and a large-scale integration and all that of semiconductors is what's creditable for a lot of the developments and should be acknowledged. The patterns of the telecommunication system also makes me think of the discourse of Herb Schiller and others published by U of I Press, Mass Communication and American Empire. And there, and Eric Barnow and others outlined the way the patterns of communication, I mean, precursor to AT&T, et cetera, was they controlled the long lines to South America and other regions, mm-hmm. and always had the question I'm getting at, I guess, I just want to listen.
So far,
respond,
I'm with
basically.
You.
But the I see a contemporary thing also in this advantage of having the more direct access to the newer technologies is this amazing story of the high frequency arbitragers who basically have faster computers in closer proximity to switches and they just use that to basically manufacture money because they have this competitive advantage. And I think I don't know where that leads exactly to, but I'd like for you to respond to some of that.
Yeah, let me jump in if I will. I agree entirely that the governmental institutions at the federal, state, and municipal level have played a vital and underappreciated role in shaping communication networks. And if there were three words to summarize the argument of the book, it's that politics have technologies. Politics shape networks. And yes, I agree entirely about DARPA. I think it is astonishing the extent to which we underplay the role of governmental institutions in late 20th century communications. And what I'm trying to do is to show the role of governmental institutions in shaping business strategy in the 19th century. And these governmental institutions are not only federal, the post office, absolutely central as a model and exemplar in the 19th century, as well as by far the largest communications network in terms of revenue. Not only as an exemplar, but also in actually shaping the ways in which corporations evolve. So I'm with you there. The concept of free enterprise is unknown in the 19th century. As far as I've been able to tell doing keyword searches, it emerges in the 19-aughts and teens as a response to Teddy Roosevelt's efforts to regulate big business. So it's an ideological construct from the beginning. The concept of private enterprise cannot be found before the 1830s. Now, having said all that, it's interesting that your comment went to focus on, in the end, business people who are actually manipulating spectrum, because I do think it's important in the United States to recognize the constant interplay between governmental institutions and business strategy. And certain political economy creates opportunities for certain kinds of entrepreneurs and discourages opportunities for other kinds of entrepreneurs. And it seems to me that that's the realm in which this discussion should go forward. On the subject of international communications, Western Union in the 19th century largely eschewed a major role in international communications because that role was played by Great Britain, and the United States was really part of a British communication network, and that greatly irked AT&T President Theodore Vail in the First World War, who was intent upon making the United States the center of world communications. He was, in his own lifetime, largely unsuccessful. But with the radio policy that was developed in the United States in the 1920s, the United States began to emerge as a key player in electrical communications, in radio. We never had a dominant position in cable, and Western Union recognized itself as a stepchild to the British cable monopoly. So I think if we look in terms of international political economy, part of the story is the relative position of the United States in relation to the other great world powers. And our rise to dominance really is a story of the mid and late 20th century.
Right. We are at our midpoint here of this hour of Focus. We're talking with Richard John about his book, Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications. Belknap Harvard is the publisher. It takes a look at some of the history of the development of the telephone and the telegraph. And questions are certainly welcome. Again, this morning, we're talking with Richard John. If you have questions about the development of communications medium in the media in this country, that's what we're doing this morning. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Something here I'd like to have you talk about here. If you look at the early years of both the telephone and the telegraph, it seems that the people who were involved in it never thought that they would become mass media, that large numbers of people would use them. The head of Western Union at one point said, even if a telegram was as cheap as a letter, most people would just send letters. And also the people who were involved in the telephone companies, they said, oh, there would be a, never be a time when more than just a few people would ever make a telephone call. Well, I guess the telegraph never really, they never really did start thinking of that as something that could have mass appeal. But at some point, they did indeed start thinking of the telephone. Those folks started thinking of the telephone as something that everybody would have access to. What was it that particularly when it came to the phone, that resulted in that change of thinking?
Well, there was good reason to retain the exclusivity of the telephone, and that was the vision of the first generation of promoters. Charles Norman Fay in Chicago declared in the mid-1880s that there'd never be a time when more than one-half of 1% of Americans would ever have occasion to make a telephone call. And he was a businessman. He was a sensible man. His views were in keeping with that of his generation. He recognized that the switching costs were extraordinarily high, the capital costs of expanding the network extraordinarily high, and he was content to make large profits on small volume inside the city of Chicago, serving a business market and the various ancillary cities around Chicago. It's a fascinating question as to why did this change. It didn't change in Toronto, in Canada. It did change in Chicago and in other American cities. And it changed in large part because of the threat of regulation, the threat, that is, of maximum rates, of an attempt to prevent the telephone companies from putting their wires underground, that is to say, prevent them from expanding, and to grant charters to rivals. That these initiatives, which were promoted by city governments, and often perhaps appropriate with the previous news announcement, corrupt city governments, that is to say, the veniality of politicians is a central part of the story of the popularization of the telephone, the challenge that they posed for telephone managers led a second generation of telephone managers, including in Chicago, a very capable fellow by the name of Angus Hibbard. And the book has a whole chapter on Chicago because it turns out the popularization of the telephone in Chicago is in many ways the key to understanding the story in American big cities. That Hibbard and the cohort of managers, second generation, recognized that by expanding access to the telephone, even though it was economically disadvantageous, at least in the short term, that it would expand their base of support within the citizenry, and that would enable them to beat down the aldermen. And that is precisely what happened in the 1880s. 5,000 Chicagoans signed petitions declaring that the telephone service was abominable. And this was quite astonishing, since at the time I think there were only about 4,000 telephones in the city of Chicago. 1913, when the comparable petitions are sent around, the overwhelming majority of Chicagoans who were polled contend that they're content with existing telephone service. They don't want any rivals. They simply want the existing telephone company, which was the Bell operating company, Bell Associated operating company. They wanted that company to be regulated better. And that outcome would have been inconceivable had not the telephone company, beginning around 1900, recognized in a way the error of its ways and begun to market telephone service in a new way. And they did it in a really fascinating way. They abandoned their prior a commitment to what was called flat rate service. That is to say, well, you can have telephone service for X dollars per month. And that was very easy to do the accounting for, because all you need is a calendar to figure out how much people pay. Around 1900 in Chicago, and a couple of years earlier in New York City, this was a development that really began in the big cities, the managers recognized that they could differentiate telephone service. That is to say, they could provide telephone service for individuals who only wanted to make a couple calls a month, and you could actually charge by call. In Chicago, in fact, almost half the telephones in 1910 were what they called nickel in the slots, which were telephones you had in your own home, boarding house, parlor, and you actually had to put a nickel in every time you wanted to make a telephone call. And that was how telephone service was popularized, by moving away from flat rates and by providing an enormous menu of options for different groups, different individuals. And it was that process that created the presumption that telephone service would in fact be accessible to all, and which was then taken for granted by 1910. The telegraph was not presumed to be accessible to all until that year. And in fact, it was in that year when Bell takes over Western Union, and that the president of Bell, a fellow by the name of Vail, proclaims that what we're going to do is we're going to provide something that he called universal service. And by universal service, he meant many things, but one of the things he meant by universal service was we're going to provide low-cost local telephone service and low-cost, long-distance telegraph service, and link the two of them together. And that was, at the time, a quite radical idea. And that was an idea, in fact, that would shape the Bell system for the rest of its history up until its dissolution in 1984. That is to say, low-cost, local telephone service was the civic ideal. Long-distance service, something a little bit different. We'll try to provide it at low cost, but if we can't, the local service is the key. So, of course, AT&T was unable to provide the low-cost, long-distance service in 1914 when the Federal Justice Department decreed that the merger of AT&T and Western Union violated antitrust laws, the Sherman Act. So in a way, at that point in time, was the end of universal service, Vail's vision, because from 1914, really until 1970s, long-distance telephone service remained quite expensive. Mm. And Americans never really took to the telegraph as they had in Britain, France, Switzerland, Belgium, European countries. The telegraph was a limited medium for a relatively restricted clientele. Even in its heyday, Western Union never brought in anything, even a fraction of the revenue the post office brought in.
And that's and people now certainly would be familiar with this company that we have that's called AT&T. What they may not realize is that's a reflection of the history that that you're talking about here. And at one point, those letters, AT&T, stood for American Telephone and Telegraph.
That's right. And the story even becomes more complicated, more interesting, when we realize that the present-day AT&T, and many listeners will remember this, was Southwestern Bell Telephone Company, which before that had been Illinois Telephone Company. That is to say, the current AT&T is the product of the merger of operating companies, of which the most important, the jewel in the crown, was the Chicago Telephone Company. So today, the two giants that are battling it out, AT&T and Verizon, are the heirs to the big city telephone, the most important big city telephone operating companies in the 19-teens. In the case of AT&T, it was the Chicago Telephone Company. In the case of Verizon, it was the New York Telephone Company. That is to say, it was not long distance in the present moment that was absolutely essential to the financial health of the corporations that now dominate the networks. It was instead the provisioning of local telephone service. Mm-hmm. And AT&T, the old AT&T, made, it seems in retrospect, a tragic mistake from the point of view of AT&T and its shareholders by divesting itself of the operating companies in 1984 and keeping long distance and R&D and manufacturing. And in doing that, in effect, it deprived itself of the revenue source that Southwestern Bell would take advantage of in reconstituting itself as present-day AT&T. Mm-hmm. All those acronyms can be a little confusing, but it could be put very simply that the money to be made in the early telephone business was made at the municipal level, not long distance.
Yeah.
And it was that money that was then making possible the creation of the long-distance telephone network that AT&T celebrated largely for publicity reasons.
Yeah, I'm really tickled, too, about that idea that residential phone service was a payphone, that you would actually have a payphone in your house.
You know, I was so surprised by that when I first discovered it that I actually sought out Chicagoans who remembered the nickel in the slots. And there are such people. And they'd put you could actually use a slug, and you'd have a little bowl in your parlor, and you'd put a slug in rather than a nickel that was configured you could use either. And that would make it possible for you then to make your telephone call. And it was considered perfectly normal, perfectly acceptable. You didn't want to pay a monthly fee. And more importantly, and this is something that we know from cell phone today, you never had to run the risk of getting a bill that you, oh my gosh, someone in your family or someone in your boarding house had made an expensive telephone call. Because if they'd made that expensive telephone call, well, they would have been there plugging the nickels themselves.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour, Richard John, again, his book is Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications. It's about the development of the telegraph and telephone systems here in the United States. It's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. Our guest, Richard John, is professor of journalism in the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. We have a couple of callers here, and we'll get right back to the callers and talk with someone in Pasodum here, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Just a question, maybe a little more contemporary than what you've talked about so far, and that's, I heard recently, and not in detail, but Google talking to Verizon or other big carriers of internet service about big companies like Google having access to high-speed lines, much higher speed lines than the rest of the users of the internet, and the effect that may have on, well, on future Googles, if you will, someone else being able to, not being able to compete with fast service like Google would have access to, and your opinion, your comments, I guess, on where the role of regulation would come in something like that.
Well, I'm not a prophet and I'm not a policy analyst, but I will say that corporations that have as large a market share as Google had better realize that they are, in effect, in the public service. They have a civic mandate, and Google has said this flat out, and therefore they should behave in a manner that will keep them out of regulatory trouble. And one way they can do that is by preserving norms of equal access, which are very deeply embedded. Google, just as an observer of journalism, is a very effective publicist, and it reminds me in some ways of AT&T. But if we think of the analogy between Google and AT&T, AT&T claimed that it was in favor of regulation, that it wanted to provide low-cost local service, and that it had a civic mandate. AT&T was adamant in stating that it's not about profits, it's not a private enterprise, it has a civic mandate. And it seems to me that Google is moving in that direction. How the specifics of its relationship with Verizon will go, I can't say. Though I will say that had such a initiative been proposed early in the 20th century, it would have raised the eyebrows of Justice Department antitrust lawyers. And that's a question about the current state of antitrust or current state of government regulation. Similar questions are raised by attempts of Google, which claims not to be a content provider, to get into the content provision business, say, by providing proprietary news. And those sorts of issues, it seems to me, as a historian, I can say, are issues that have been frowned upon by not only antitrust lawyers, but also by lawmakers in Congress.
All right. I hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's talk with someone else. This is Danville, our toll-free line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm one of those people that lived in Chicago in 1930 and remember the nickels in the telephone.
Oh, that's wonderful. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to make a telephone call? Did you have
no,
nickels?
Not really, because I was 2 years old at the time, and I talked with my older sister many years ago. I said, do you remember someone coming to the apartment and collecting nickels from our telephone? And she said, oh, no. You know, and when I heard this subject being announced this morning, I thought, I wonder if that man can tell me if that was true, that they had nickels in the telephone. And sure enough, you did. And I thank you for that.
All right, well, thank you. And it is the case, Professor John, that indeed there was somebody who worked for the phone company who periodically would come to your house to collect the change.
Yes, in the very early days, you keep a little slip of paper. If you had to have it was $1.50 a month, a nickel a day. Yeah, 30 times nickel, $1.50. And if you had more than that, you could actually get credit. And they put a little piece of paper in the box. And, of course, someone had to have access to the telephone. And I think they worked it out that, oh, it would be such and such a morning. Someone has to be home or at the boarding house. But there were these encounters. I doubt anyone is alive who was collector, and it's very hard to get information on them. But they were sort of like the fellow who does the gas meter. They got information about what was going on in the neighborhood, and they sort of had a friendly relationship with, like the man, I suppose, with everybody in the environs. But they were absolutely ubiquitous in Chicago. There were hundreds of thousands of these telephones at their peak. In drugstores, a drugstore would try to use the telephone as a loss leader and bring people into their store. And well, how do you bring someone into one drugstore as opposed to another? Well, you actually would issue slugs that could only be used at the drugstore that issued them. And that persisted up until the Second World War. So people would carry around slugs in their pockets that would only work at such and such drugstore in such and such a corner. And that was a way for that drugstore to ensure foot traffic. So it was a fascinating set of accommodations to a rapidly expanding urban metropolis. But it was a set of compromises, a set of improvisations that worked extraordinarily well, often frowned upon by central management in New York City. But they never quite understood what was going on in Chicago, but worked very well in Chicago and helped to popularize the medium. And that may be a lesson for business strategists today, that it's important really to understand your user, to recognize that not all users have the same needs, wants, or desires, regardless of their income, and to find innovative ways that sort of meet the users where they are and to provide them with the service that they want and are willing to pay for. Mm. So to the extent that I can play business consultant, I suppose the Chicago nickel in the slots might provide a lesson or two.
Something this may indeed be more complicated than we can do in about the 5 minutes that we have left, but I'm interested in, again, maybe having you make some more comparisons between the way telecommunications developed in the United States and the way that it developed in Europe, and what were the reasons for the important differences?
Well, the case of the telegraph is really quite striking. In Britain and France, the government gained a control over the telegraph very early. And in part, this was because you had a burgeoning postal administration that had administrators who were sort of ambitious and they could get the ear of Parliament. In part, there was concern about surveillance, that the government needed to retain control over these very sensitive means of communication. In France, the telegraph was invented, but it was not electrical. It was invented in the 1790s, known as the optical telegraph. And that medium was a monopoly of the government. That is to say, no merchant could use the optical telegraph because it was felt that would give them an unfair advantage, getting back to the early caller talking about those high-speed traders. In the United States, there were bold plans for optical telegraphs going back to the 1800s and the fellow, in fact, who ran the New York optical telegraph in the 1820s, a fellow named Samuel Reed, is perhaps best known to history as the designer of the 13-stripe American flag, which was a naval pennant, a kind of an optical telegraph. Well, when Reed thought about the optical telegraph, and he was very influential for Morse, he thought about it being accessible to merchants. And that was a real difference between telegraph policy in Britain, France, and the United States. Merchants were at the center of the United States. In Britain, the kind of killer app for the telegraph, as it were, was regulating railroads, preventing trains from banging into each other. That application was much more slowly to be developed in the United States, contrary to the popular mythology of the railroad and telegraph marching across the continent. They really didn't march together across the continent in the United States, but they marched across the British Isles, and they were comparable developments in other European countries, especially Prussia. So merchants were first in the United States, and railroads in Britain. In the case of the telephone, to expand on that, when the post office got control of the telegraph, at least in Britain, by 1870, they bought it up, there was the convention that the telegraph should be, like the post office, accessible to all. And there were efforts to provide low-cost telegraph service, largely because it was could be subsidized by the post office. In the case of the telephone, the story is very, very different. In the United States, the telephone developed, the money to be made was in the big cities, and the key political forum were the municipalities. In Britain and Canada, very quickly, the key municipalities was the central government. And the central government had an interest in protecting the telegraph, and therefore it stifled the telephone. In the United States, that did not happen. The telephone and the telegraph emerged as rivals. In part, that's because they were both private enterprises, but also extremely important was the regulatory regime, municipal government in the case of the telephones and state government in the case of the telegraph. Any well-informed observer in 1900 would agree that the United States had by far the best telephone network in the world inside the cities. We even had telephones in hotels, which was considered astonishing, every hotel room. And that was not simply because of the entrepreneurial acumen of Alexander Graham Bell and the Bell managers, but because we had a competitive political economy focused at the level of the municipality, in which individual municipalities had a vested interest in regulating the telephone and therefore encouraging the promoters to find ways to expand access in ways that would limit the extortion of the city government. It's a remarkable story, and it's a very different story from any other country in the world, with the possible exception of some of the Scandinavian countries. Stockholm was close to the United States in levels of penetration, but they never had the technological innovations in switching because the network was just not as big.
Yeah, and again, to go back to something we talked about earlier, though, I'm also struck by how it is, what a continuing part of this story is that how you get service to underserved areas and how it is that the telephone was so well developed in cities, but there was still a question about, well, what do you do for people in rural areas? How do you provide them with service? And it seems like we're still wrestling with that.
You know, I should emphasize, and there will be listeners in Illinois who know full well, that Bell was just one of thousands of telephone companies in the United States in the 1900s and teens. We had an extraordinarily active, independent telephone movement that provided telephone service in municipalities, large, small farms, and what have you. And that has been emphasized by recent students of the subject as the distinctive American contribution. I would contend it's a distinctive American contribution, which again is in part because of the way the regulations are set up. It was possible to have such an entrepreneurial efflorescence. But the real innovations technologically came in the big cities, and the independents, much like a lot of the internet companies of the 1990s, were often financed in an irregular fashion, and they went back, many of them, not all. Many of the larger ones went bankrupt, and it was their financial problems that led Bell to really promote one of the reasons that led Bell to promote regulation in order to stabilize the industry. So I wouldn't want any listener to come away thinking that Bell, AT&T is the whole story. It most certainly is not, but it is the main story in the big cities. It's the story where technological innovation and where political innovation came from, and it was actually the accommodation of the independents in the 19-teens that created the distinctive landscape that remained pretty much unchanged up until 1984. In effect, there was an entente. There was a kind of a political settlement. You get this part of the country, we'll get that part of the country. And that was worked out politically, and that was a great boon for the independents, because as soon as it was clear that they would be able to, say, to retain Rochester, or they'd be able to retain certain counties in southern Illinois, then they could get the requisite funding, often from local bankers, in order to upgrade the level of service that their users demanded. So it is a complicated story, and it is one in which questions of access are key. The kinds of access issues that the Bell leaders were most concerned about involved, say, the relationship between New York City and upstate New York, that they'd shift money from New York City to upstate New York, and they began doing that in the 19-teens in order to provide a larger network. But by no means did AT&T cover the entire country, and that would have been inconceivable, really, until rural electrification in the 1930s. And then after the Second World War, AT&T, they began to shift money from long distance to municipalities, including small towns, in compliance with state regulations and in an effort to preserve their political position, but also in an effort to provide the promise or to fulfill the promise of universal access.
We must stop there because we're here at the end of the time, but there is much more to this story, and it's quite an interesting book. And if you'd like to read more about the development of telephone, telegraph in the United States and what that meant for the country, the book to look for is Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications. It's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press by our guest Richard John. He is professor of journalism at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. And Professor John, we want to say to you, thanks very much for spending some time with us today.
Well, thank you so much, David. I enjoyed it very much.
And also we want to thank the folks at the other end there, the studios in at Columbia, for providing us with a good high-quality connection here for the program.